for the opposed focus, so you're going to ignore the other thing. Right? You know that. You know that if you name the reason why you're hurt, that keeps being the focus of your life. You all know that? You've all tried that one? You name why you're happy, then that becomes the focus of your life. It's very nice to use the principle of the shrine or altar, isn't it? Use the power of ignorance. Decide how one wants to focus. And then work with that. Focus.
The power of
focus, yeah. So that's what ignorance is. You're focusing on this, ignoring everything else. Do you have any questions after lunch that you want to bring forward before I plunge ahead?
I'm not sure that it's probably
you're not? Oh, this is wonderful, and I would like to hear about that because I don't have the experience you do. So what brings that to your mind?
I just put you saying this morning about that.
And what brings to you that you're not sure it's suffering?
I don't
think it's particular to suffering. Interesting. I think men get more single-minded than women. And who is it, Piaget, was that the guy's name, who did the psychology, who did the testing with children, did 500 kids, did he establish, you know, a certain, what was it he was doing, cultural, how they operated, what age, who did what, when, did this brilliant study, but then later it was discovered that he did it all with male. Male? Did you know that? Interesting, eh? So then they did it again with males and females, mixed groups, and then separately males and females. The test is kind of like this, it has this kind of thing to see what kind of social awareness, consciousness develops at what age. This is part of like the PSA study, right? The sociology, isn't it, basically? And one of the questions, for example, there's a pharmacy in town, it's closed, your child is ill. Is it alright for you? Is it moral for you to break into the pharmacy because you have to get the medicine or your child will die? The doctor isn't available. No one, you know? Okay? So males will basically almost always answer yes. Females will say, well, that depends. Do I know the pharmacist? Interesting, eh? A female mind generally looks more for a networking response. May I say, okay, let's fix the problem. And that has been, you know, tested out, what?
You're lucky.
No. And very well, the male aspect of your being, which is why in Buddhism they say when, in that, you know, the question comes up about males and females and who can awaken. And I remember being very involved in Buddha Dharma in the beginning of my introduction to it, and then somebody telling me that as a female I didn't have a hope in heaven, hell, or earth of actually getting anywhere with it. I had to be reborn as a male. And at this time there was this wonderful teacher, my beloved teacher, Ananda Bodhi, in the beginning of his teaching in Canada, he used to invite other teachers to come and teach for 3-4 months at a time, and they would teach the meditation and the classes and everything, sometimes 6-7 months at a time. This wonderful, wonderful sayadaw from, this was that beautiful teacher from Sri Lanka was there. And so I said to him, you know, is it true that, women can't awaken? And he said, do you see yourself in life or do you see life in yourself? Which still totally stops me. Like, I don't go anywhere then, right? I don't pursue that. Right? Say, well, yeah, that's a good question. But in fact, if you take that question and hold it, you begin to see how your mind works. It was a beautiful answer, wasn't it? And then in the Tibetan tradition, they say, Gampopa says, if a woman has the view, she could probably awaken more easily than a man. That is to say, if she sees where there is to go, a male will have a better, quicker perception. This is very general. Very better, quicker perception of where there is to go. You can see my mind at a certain point. I gather experience, network. At a certain point, my mind clicks in. And it's because of the way my mind clicks in that people usually find me an interesting teacher, because I have an overview. I can tell all these stories to give it relevance. Does that make sense to you? It's not just the point. I also do relationships. You see? And that's what you have to be able to do, is have both of them together. One is called knowing and the other is called being. Being is understanding the interrelationship. And knowing is what point are you getting to with it. So they both have their strengths and they both have their weaknesses, really. And I'm glad I'm female.
What's that?
And I'm glad I'm female.
Oh.
It is, isn't it? Because after all, that's what I got. Is that sufficient to agree with you? I'm sure you're glad you're male.
Yeah, that's fine.
The ideal is to be able to have both aspects working balanced in a balanced way. That's what you're working for. That's why emotion, which is the interrelationship, how things tie together, and the view together make up the stupa. It is, the stupa is the male and female together. And therefore, attainment. You only got half the story, I don't know. You can have a beautiful understanding but no compassion. Or you have extremely wonderful compassion but you don't know what to do with it. You're gonna have both, if you haven't the view. So for women, it is a struggle sometimes to get the view. Because we have babies. It was very interesting, although I placed my daughter for adoption when she was 2 years old, when I was in a playground or something, any two-year-old I heard, I would be right there, and my face would just a flash. Nothing to do with, you know, nothing to do with my circumstance, because she wasn't around. Five-year-olds. There's adapt to 5-year-olds, everyone. Any of you women had that experience? Can I see a show of hands here? How about men? Is it as strong for you, do you think, it is for women? Maybe from being with a child? From not being with a child? How about the children you don't know you've had? Your body changes differently with pregnancy with a woman than with a man. The clock's all there. It doesn't matter whether you have a miscarriage, you have an abortion, you have a child, do adoption. Everything is changed. The minute you can see, your whole consciousness has shifted. And there ain't no way out. The man, in a way, it's like that, but it's more like that in relationship with the woman and how you work that relationship. Not so much. Does that make sense to you?
It's more indirect.
Yeah, it's more indirect. And it's like everything about your whole, your psyche, how it works, the rhythms of your body, everything is totally shifted. So how to get out of that interrelationship and get the view without wondering how everybody's doing. Well, do I know the pharmacist? Without checking out everything in town. Interesting, huh? And nobody caught that with Piaget. Some of you here have done the studies and you didn't know that? Interesting, isn't it? Nobody caught that with Piaget for probably about 100 years. And somebody said, wait a minute. I think he did this at a boys' school. And indeed, he has. Curious. So then sociology began to change its views just a tad. Just a bit there. Sometimes this isn't exactly the best test. And the test began to be updated and changed. That's what? I'm sure you all wanted to know that. But it is interesting, isn't it? It's interesting when you teach meditation to know that there is actually a slightly different approach, generally speaking, not always. And I totally agree, your mind works more in a masculine way. And that's quite common. Sometimes it happens through life, sometimes somebody is born with more of that kind of way of their mind working, whether the body is male or female, you know? But when you teach meditation, sometimes you really do notice that for this person, this would be, generally speaking, according to the rules of meditation theory, give this to this type of person, this to that. But actually, this type of person is a female there. So adapt it. And meditation is a skill, you know, it's like an art, it's the art of mind. How to create the enlightened mental state. That's what you do. It's an art. So there are rules, there are skills you learn, but then the composition requires a certain letting go of rules. You have to train in the rules so well that you know how to let go. Is that true?
Okay, if I might, just on this anatomy, biology and psychology, most of the, in surgery on a human body, most of the books that follow today were composed by men working on cadavers 300 or 400 years ago. Standard text. Recently, some friends of mine, two male surgeons in Melbourne, over about the last 5 years, decided that they had a very mature, highly experienced female surgeon with a group of young female surgeons. They decided to take the body to pieces in another way from their perspective. And it's very enlightening for female, that's what they discovered.
Mm. Are you going to say more?
Well, to put it very importantly, because of physiology and stuff like that, but some of the damaging considerations and all misconceptions that males had about the female reproductive organs and the clitoris, for instance, being so big and this, that and the other. And when the female surgeons took it together, took it pieces, and looked at it, it's become 50 times as large.
Oh, in drawing. In the
actual nervous structure.
Yeah.
Where it goes and what it does.
And yeah. And what its value is in the human body.
This rough
butchery, yeah.
Because of ignorance.
Right.
From a general male
perception, yeah.
Of surgery.
You can't pee out of it and it doesn't erect to where I can see it, so therefore
it's
not very important.
And
nobody ever asked any of the women, I guess.
No, well look what happens. It's very restless.
It's true.
Terrible.
I'm sorry. It's wonderful, thank you. It's wonderful. It's exactly, and it's exactly ignorant. You know, when ignorance is used against you, you don't know what you don't see. I mean, this is a kind of a fun example in a certain way because we can do our battle of the genders kind of thing with it, you know, if we want to. But really, it's a beautiful teaching on ignorance, isn't it?
Totally.
You have a whole view, and that supports it. I mean, you know, the Incans did not see the first people that sailed to the shore. They didn't see them. They were like sailing right there.
Ocean. Boat.
They saw the second. Saw the second wave. Not the first. So these people just sort of appeared. Very godlike. And they looked according to the myths of the gods. So it's a similar kind of quality, isn't it? It's like ignorance is very interesting. We don't believe that ignorance is operating in our life because we can't see beyond it yet. But we're within the dome of the ignorance all the time. So how to actually start questioning that before you go mad is a really reasonable you know, without going crazy or having to take drugs or, you know, some of the other ways they're out. It's a very interesting thing. Don't you think so? So, for example, visiting an old age home is like a major way for all of us to actually poke a little hole in our sense of ignorance. And then, of course, we know we're aging. But you have no idea how valuable that would be for you. Like, soften a whole kind of inability to see. And how much that will pay off in terms of your ability to understand and interrelate with the world and not get caught. Not get caught. It's very useful to actually know what is. That's wonderful. I congratulate the people you know who are doing this. It's a wonderful thing to do. Any place that we can bring ignorance into its proper proportion, where it's our servant rather than we are its prison, is useful. Ignorance is a brilliant servant. It's like life and just like they're wonderful servants. But if they're ruling, you know, glug, 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 folks, right down the drain you go. But if they're advisors, oh, it's really wonderful. The lunch we had today. Thank you for that. Any other questions as we can?
Just when we were talking about the milestone of it in terms of harnessing and taking out all the options and that being the principle of view, like it's kind of hard to get the view from that perspective. I'm not quite sure how you move that from the view, how you see the view.
The view is, if you think that the eight worldly dharmas are more important than understand the illusory nature of existence, you're going to wander for a long time. The power of renunciation. The renunciation is properly, rightly, with your heart, your chest. Not some brave jumping over a cliff, you know. Forget it, you know. Good in movies, and that's about it. And not because other people are doing it, but because your heart moves it. It is essentially always coming down to the fact that you are the one who will bear the results of your decision. So that's where you have to stand. And the more kind you are in your decisions, in every direction, in it and out of it, the easier it will be when they come back. Is that true? You can't do a lot about what's going to arise in life. Where the terrorist, whatever it may be, disease, old age, sickness, death, insanity, whatever it may be, where the terrorist is going to arise, you cannot do much about. You can do everything about your reaction. The real path. Okay, now. That affects the brain. Does it not? I think so. Like that, it's not quite so dramatic as, you know, CNN and, oh, CNN. It's not quite so dramatic. Get a little adrenaline feed going.
But so, you know that sort of story about that way? Rampant terrorists is crouching to death and to monastery, and he said to the abbot,
Do you know that I could cut your head off without blinking an eye? And the abbot just said, do you know you could cut my head off without blinking an eye? And he became his disciple. So that's
beautiful,
saying,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
And when you look at what all the money and power in the world is trying to do, you can see that they won't do it.
Yeah.
All we can do is go that way.
You can hold your biceps really bigger than everybody in the block until you get so old that they collapse. And somebody is going to be bigger biceps than you. Damn. You can do plastic surgery. You can do all those things. But damn. Hugh Hefner may be able to take Viagra and return to his old way of life. He's going to die anyway. They'll have to build a special coffin for him. And the hardest thing to do is let go of your answers. Exactly what you're saying. Because it's so comforting. They make you feel so safe, don't they? If you've got the right answer, you're safe somehow, aren't you? Say some more. So Buddhism is that all of the schools, all these students are the graduated stages of learning how to trust yourself, to just be able to see things as they are without your answers. Every step gives you more power in just being able to just see what is, not what your hope is, and not what you know your ancestors believed in, and not what the Buddha said, or not what Christ said. Any book said, not what, if you believe this, maybe, you know, your friends will let you come back into your social life, or, you know, none of those things. But just what is liberation is liberation from wrong views and wrong emotions. There's the cessation of suffering because the consciousness is no longer caught in trying to make what is not what is. Therefore there's compassion, therefore there's clarity, therefore there's no drive. You no longer hold yourself separate from anything. That's what liberation is. What's different, isn't it, when you're asking me? Not having a right answer, that's too easy. I told you, didn't I, about, you know, when my teacher said I should start teaching her for you. When I didn't know, because I knew for a long time.
Yeah. And he really was a good teacher, and he was, and he, how that should have been described. And, I could chant off the laundry list. I'm brilliant now, but then I was like, superbly brilliant. I did these runs with those laundry lists like you wouldn't believe, but I ticked them off, yeah. And, you know, he never asked me to teach. He helped them. And I would go to his class and it was very compassionate. Sat there, truly, you know, listening, humble heart, even when they didn't quite teach it properly. Very humble. Didn't comment to them, and just noticed myself, I would have it. Told them afterward how much I enjoyed their teaching, and I expressed appreciation, and he still never asked me to teach. And then I did a retreat, and it was like very obvious that I didn't. And then a girl arose instead of suffering. Total wrath. It happened because I got to a point in the practice where there was just absolutely essential, total success. Yeah, absolute success. Pointless, I wasn't pointless, wasn't it? And I'm sitting there saying, oh, what's the use? And I lean back. Oh, what's the use? Because there's no energy. And then I get up and I walk over the table and I find my cigarettes and I light a cigarette and I think, what's the use? And I'm looking at the cigarette and all of a sudden I just allow the despair. And I threw him into the air, depressed, smoking a cigarette. I didn't know anything. Then the next day he said to me, well, you should start teaching. So I said, oh, you know, I've never known you're trying to be wrong first. Now last week I had something to do. I don't know a thing. I like no. You see, it's turning around again. And we protect it. It has to be done carefully. It has to be done carefully. You have to do it respectfully. You don't trash anything. There are stages. They are specific. You can't get there unless you get it. To some degree. Every difference is important. You know that there's only the sudden path to awakening after a long time of treading the gradual path. And if you want the sudden path to ripen, it's probably good to do a lot of gradual path practice. It's amazing how those gradual path practices become more and more profound and deep. Simple little things like letting go of the past, letting go of the future, where you fall and you resurrect. Simple little things. Change your whole life. Because you don't, you can. So then, if you do that, but with the door open, you know that poem I mean? I have been knocking on the door, wanting to know these, and I have been living on the lip of insanity, knocking on the door, wanting to know reasons. It opens. I've been knocking for me inside. So that's what you're doing. What you're doing for foundations of the mind. You're teaching your mind not to try to get something in the future, not trying to get something from the past. not your past answers, applied on the present moment of breath, not where it's going to take you, not what you're going to get from this practice, but just to be in the breath you're in with unknowing awareness. First breath ever. Let go of the past, let go of the future. You know the offering bowls. I think I talked about the offering bowls last time I was here. First one is water for drinking, second one is water for washing. First one is water for drinking because it cuts down the thirst, your future, the desire that chases you into the future. Second one is water for washing, and it's for feet because it washes away the dust of the past, so that gives you ability to stay where you are. So in the Sakya tradition, they call the two waters an ocean of hearing. They say A-P-A-R-I-N-T, but to me it's both an ocean of hearing, of being here and so therefore hearing. So when you're doing the meditation, you become an ocean of hearing. Just for a moment, it's a very beautiful feeling, isn't it? Even if it lasts like 1 millionth of a second. That's what I usually mean. You only have to collect one day of those 1 millionth of a second. Might as well start now. Who knows how many you've already collected? Who knows how many grains of rice have already been thrown, and you might be standing right over that needle, and it might just be levels of stuff all there, maybe 50. Gonna be there. It's just a perfect precious feeling. Who knows whether the Buddha is waiting to have you in it? Nobody. Who knows whether you need special circumstances? Or whether this is it. All you gotta do is be willing. For the benefit of all of you. In every moment. Ananda, the Buddha's cousin, he awakened when he was halfway between lying down and standing. He decided he was going to have a little nap. He was walking over there, and when he was neither here nor there, right between the two, just was just long enough for him to let go. And when you read the stories of the Buddha's awakening, he did the experiences of the eight jhanas. He went from form level, then there's a little gap in between, to the formless level, and back down through the formless levels, that gap, and then through the form levels, and back up through the form levels, and the gap between form and formless is when he experienced awakening. Does it sound like I'm on a scene here? When there was no knowing or unknowing, consciousness capable of objects but without objects. That was the awakening. Formless levels, there's boundless consciousness, so there's no capable ability of focus. You know, when you experience the formless level, any of you ever experienced formless level in meditation? You know you've experienced because after the fact, you're happy. Be like me, with my background, you start looking around to see who's burning marijuana. That's terrible. Then you realize there's no smoke in the air. Or, you know, first time I experienced the formless time, I was meditating on the element. So I was doing fire to have this fireplace, this house. And, piece of cardboard sort of with a big size circle cut out of that, and you build a fire and then you put the cushion in there and you sit so far away and you say Tejo, and you have a sense of the fire for about 30 seconds, so you slowly close your eyes as you recreate the fire in your mind's eye so you can hold it perfectly so that you can't tell the difference at some point in or out of whether your eyes are open or not. And then when you can do that, then you take that, what they call the inner Christina, and you walk with it. You know, and this is like, these are the exercises to develop concentration itself, and they're wonderful to do.
And we've never had the opportunity of doing them. It's a wonderful practice. They're beautiful to do. There's a Tibetan form of them, and there's also the Theravada form. Eight of them are wonderful to do. And so I have this fire. I've got it built up, you know, winter in Ontario, and so find a nice fire built up. I've got it really built up. Tejo, 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 tejo. And I open my eyes and the fire's there. And the fire went there. And it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon and it's dark in the room. So, because when you go, when you begin to do meditation and develop concentration, you can, when you develop some concentration, you can all of a sudden, the mind can just advert to a formless realm, and then you only know because a whole bunch of time has passed because you're giggling. It can be 1/10 of a second, but it is a great joyousness that's present because you have had an experience of consciousness without blemish, without any obscurity, and without any conflicting emotional state. And it's a very joyful experience. So you're very joyful. But you're not lacking any awareness. So in the Buddhist tradition, except for some people who teach Vipassana in the Theravada style, supposedly, there seems to be a bias against jhana because I guess people get stuck in it. Or absorption, but in fact it's very useful to be able to experience absorption because then you know what your mind really tastes like. You know it's not a dream. You say, yeah, you're supposed to sit here all the time. You get, it's because the mind has temporarily settled. You know, oh, this is what my consciousness is. This is what consciousness is everywhere. Then it may give you more power to really do the work. You see, if you have a real experience. And if you want to read somebody who's just brilliant on that, there's a woman who, she's dead now, she was a wonderful teacher. I imagine you've all heard of her. Her name was Aya Khema, AYYAKHEMA. And that was her path, was the path of jhana and insight together. And I think probably the book Who is the Self, which was done on retreats, a taped retreat, where she's leading a retreat and she's talking about when jhana arises, how to use it. She's even talking about how to develop jhana in your day, in your practice. And she's very clear, she's a wonderful, imagine a woman, Theravadin, who practiced jhana, surviving. I mean, some of you don't know how weird that is. Talk about miracles right there. Teaching, recognize, publish. Well, obviously, this is a woman with some power of truth. She would have survived all those hurdles. I mean, isn't it beautiful? You read it? Is it just beautiful?
Not
beautiful?
Yeah, I looked at one.
Yeah. Anybody who's interested in meditation?
Just the title of the next book shows you where she's at.
Yeah.
Well, where she's been, nobody going nowhere.
Yeah.
How wonderful.
Yeah.
And she's good. She has a very unusual hand and mind and heart. Obviously, it wouldn't come out like that. But
yeah.
I don't need that to be able to look that book. That's really fantastic book.
And really gives a touch, a taste of how to use jhana or why one might want to practice jhana. Practice concentration itself. It's like a basic kind of tool of meditation, concentration, and actually you develop it to the point where you can do absorption if you choose.
Very practical.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, too practical, I think.
Yeah, really practical. Aya, her name is AYYA. KHEMA. She has several books out. The one I'm recommending in terms particularly of meditation because it was taped from her talks at a retreat. So every once in a while she says something improperly or something which I love too, and then later she'll say the same thing but differently. And so, you know, I love that myself. She excuses me. And it's called Who is the Self? And as was mentioned, Her previous book was called Being Nobody Going Nowhere. Is that Being No One Going Nowhere?
Being Nobody Going Nowhere.
Being Nobody Going Nowhere, which is also just a brilliant book. But pretty well anything that she put out is worth, if you're interested in meditation and you want a greater understanding, this is a voice of experience, very articulate, very straightforward. And lived a wonderful long life, helped many beings.
Actually, I have to ask you, in your experience as a mature woman practitioner, when you meet with a male in any of the traditions that you've worked with, some of the men you've mentioned, who've gone beyond their ignorance to a certain extent, what's the mildness about that? What can you say about that unencumbered knowledge of the maleness?
When you meet with that and it is an easy dialogue, there is no sense of sexuality and being caught in any one place or the other, place around, you know. It's the energy of male-female dancing, but that's not where the meeting is. Like the basic thing about gender is to be able to pass beyond it without denying it.
That's
really the point.
Would it be more to both, as far as your experience, and not none?
Yeah. Like in orgasm, you know, like in a really good orgasm, it's hard to say who's male and who's female at which point, right? I'm assuming that, but it seems to me my distant memories are.
Yes, I
do. That certainly for myself, it's like it has been very hard to say whether I was female or male, and the feeling from the male was very similar, that there is something that moves quite beyond gender in orgasm. So maybe without that, you know, spectacular. You know, that extraordinary, larger-than-life experience that orgasm was in those days. But that said, so that it's a non-issue. They're both there, and it's not an issue, but there is a place beyond that that's more. It's looking down from the other side of that rather than looking up to it being that. Or to work out that relationship, it's from having gone beyond that relationship, looking down. True that, why not? I could use concepts, you know what he said? And he's not fooled by it. Could use ignorance, and he's not fooled by it.
How about the realized or highly experienced female practitioners, isn't there any differences?
There's a difference between what?
The first set would be kind of pretty nice, and she had no hair. Quite a.
You sat with her?
Happy lady.
How wonderful.
Tremendously powerful from the work she'd done all her life.
Yeah.
And I really didn't know whether she was male, not just from the physical, but from the tone of her voice and the gesticulation and all the rest. I didn't know whether she was
male or female.
No, I didn't care.
It's a non-issue. How wonderful that you had that opportunity. That's just so rich. Very nice.
Tough girl.
Well, she didn't know. She knew what was involved.
Mm.
And her way of teaching was very. I'm just from her books. I never met her.
She died not that long ago.
About 3 years
ago. Yeah. She was very engaged, very social, you know, like the offering out to everybody.
Yeah,
but great teacher. Yeah. Great teacher. She's brilliant.
Yes, I know.
Why isn't it there she came from?
Did she?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Buddha Dharma is alive and well in us today. Yes, it is. So any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Very dangerous. In rather broad grounds, and I'd like to outline more that first step of the four foundations of mindfulness and then what in the present you look at is what the direction of the focus, which is what I said I would talk about this afternoon. Yeah. So it starts with the first one is awareness of body. That's what the four foundations of mindfulness are. First one is first become mindful of body. And there are a series of steps of that mindfulness classically taught in the mindfulness, four foundations of mindfulness. Classically, that have been classically developed and taught, and I thought I would just list them, and then maybe we would have a little time to actually talk about one or two of them a little bit. Does that sound all right to you? This is the outline of, I'm hoping to eventually get around to writing the stupa because I've never seen it written well, where it's talking about the 37 requisites in the stupa. So this is my sketch, my beginning sketch. So I'll just read from this, is that good? And then you can, this is not actually written, this is just sketch for me to have, know where to take it. Try to keep me on topic. As you can see, it's not always easy. The first of these, contemplation of the body, is divided into a series of investigative experiences. So that's what you're doing, you're having a series of investigative experiences. You're collecting data. You're not doing it right, you're not getting the right answer, no great lightning bolt is going to come, none of those things. You're not getting anything, you're getting rid of. Divided into a series of investigative experiences, each of which builds on the one before. They are mindfulness of the in and out breathing, which we've done. Okay. Just get a little... Didn't I do that? Mindfulness, and then after that, it switches to mindfulness of the bodily posture. So the switch to that is when you're watching the breath, and then you notice an experience somewhere in the body or the mind, and so you either say thinking, or you say sleepiness, or you say itch, or you say intention. That's clear? We did that also yesterday. Do you all remember doing that? That's good. Yeah. And then eventually you get to where you have an overall sense of your body while you're breathing. Did you get a little bit of that today when you were sitting? Like there was awareness of yourself sitting while you're breathing? So mindfulness is a four bodily posture. It builds on the previous mindfulness. Mindfulness and clarity of comprehension. Isn't that beautiful? So then you become mindful that there is clear comprehension. And it is very specific. That's what I say when it's like a dimmer switch is turned in your mind. You know what a dimmer switch is? Is that what you call them here? And that's mindfulness of clarity of comprehension. And once you have mindfulness of clarity of comprehension, then you start taking that and placing it in different ways. one of the ways you do that is then you begin to reflect on if you're going to do it, just if you're going to use the Four Foundations of Mindfulness as a direct path to enlightenment, the next thing you would do would be meditate on the 32 parts of the body. And this body of mind is composed of hair of the head, hair of the body, naka, nails, danta, teeth, tajo, skin, and it goes through this whole list of 32 parts where you look at the liver, the bile, the eczema, the brain, the whole mesentery, the whole. And when I was taught that meditation, what you had to do was first you sat, having established the mindfulness and clear comprehension, then you switched the awareness to these parts in your body until you could actually feel them. And when you could feel them, then you imagine, very like the Chod practice in the Tibetan, you imagine taking them out, and so you have 32 piles in front of you. You see, what you're doing is you're breaking down the feeling of I am somebody in this body. Neat, huh? So that's in the Theravada tradition, that's how you do that practice. Mm-hmm. So you imagine that, okay, all the head hair is there in a pile, and all the body hair is there in a pile, and then the nails are there, and then the teeth, that's easier for me. Some of you might be a little harder. The skin, and then So then, you know, you do a pile of each one, and meanwhile, you're holding your mindfulness and clarity of concentration. And if the mindfulness and clarity of concentration slips, then you drop that meditation, you go back to the breath. Is that clear? So you use the breath meditation as your guardrail. And when you have that mindfulness and clarity of comprehension, then you place it. And say, well, you know, this body is composed of these elements. I'm about to see, showing you different parts of what the body is composed of. And then what you do is, after having done that, then you meditate and you analyze the body in terms of the four elements. That those aspects of the body that have extension are like the earth element, and that those parts of the body that are like cohesion are like the water element. Those aspects of the body that are calorically hot and cold are fire element. Those elements of the body that are the vibration, the movement, are the air element. The body itself is rising in space. And then you extend that as well, so that you see that there is no difference between the earth there and the earth here. That's water there, water here, fire there, fire here, air there, air here. And whenever you lose the clarity of comprehension, you go back to the breath. I don't know how often this is taught anymore. It was, even when I was doing these practices, it was very hard to find somebody who taught it this way. And I think I was fortunate. I think I actually did find teachers who taught it the old way. And then meditation. I have never done meditation on the stages of a corpse decomposing. So there are 10 stages of a corpse decomposing that you meditate. And the instructions are very specific. You always walk to the corpse, back and forth to where the corpse is in the daytime until you clearly know the path so you're not frightened. And you can walk there any time, day or night. So there's this period of time where you give the instruction on how to walk there. And then where you sit, you don't sit down in the end of the corpse. You sit with and out of the way of animals that might be coming to the court, you know. So it's very hard in our society to get a decent court to meditate on. Leave it lying around in the neighborhood, something's going to happen to it, you know. It's, just, it's not like it used to be somehow. But even while I was still in Thailand, occasionally someone would donate their body to a meditator in a country, you know, at a forest monastery, so that somebody could meditate on the decomposing of the corpse. It's not one of the options you have on one of those fill-in things. What would you like to have done with your body? I'd like it to be given to the monastery for meditation. This isn't done. It's a very different kind of concept, isn't it? Because by the time you have worked through the analysis of the parts, there are two parts of the body, body as elements, you see the elements inside and outside, which is where you send that one to. And then you actually have done some meditation on how you are not your body and that you're not separate from your body, but you're not your body either. And then your meditations on the decomposing of a corpse that pretty well gets rid of any sense of clinging to a body. So then you clearly understand how precious a body is and how much it is not going to last and how whether or not it's worth investing the kind of care into it that one might be tempted to, or whether it's better to invest care into something that might last a little longer. What is valuable is, I mean, without disrespecting the body, what it does do and what it doesn't. That's what you've learned by meditation on the body. You've learned a need to do the other part of the body. What?
It really teaches you that you've got to think the word called the body made up of these pieces.
Exactly.
And then you no longer, every time you say, oh, my body or someone else's body,
you don't have the same image.
You don't have the same image anymore.
Subject to the same image. Okay.
So you've got this thing made up of all the parts, but it's no longer the body. It just becomes a word. So it's powerful, right?
Very powerful. Very powerful. Very powerful. And it is not unusual when somebody is doing these meditations at various times, their mind goes into total rebellion and they just want to get out because they're not willing to let go of their usual views and stuff. And get to a point where you're hoping it's stupid and a bunch of idiots and it's all just like self-centered and, you know, all those things. What really is your fear that your sense of yourself is changing. So that's why you need that. Sila. Mm-hmm. At a certain point you cannot go beyond. You do develop sila from doing these practices. But if you start feeling really shaky and you don't have faith in your teacher, probably better to quit and go develop some sila. Okay, I'll come back later. I'll go work tomorrow. I have more reason to be here. So I can just get over that. So, where do we go from here? I take off on something on my own. It's just here that is not at all of the ball sizes.
You need to go from the
decent
person to the court?
Yeah. Yeah? You have a question?
No.
Oh, no, yeah, I know. I'm just, after I go to the composition of the court, I just go blah, 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 go off on some kind of thing I'm writing here. It has no bearing on what we're talking about. Okay. Okay. Why did I take off here? Where am I going? Here.
Here they go, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, meconcephalus, stomach, excrement, brain, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, lymph, tears, serum, saliva, nasal mucus, synovial fluid, urine. So after you've done, probably you're not going to be able to do the 10 stages of the decomposing of the corpse, but you should be able to do the Theravadin equivalent to chert practice, which is the imaging of the 32 parts of the body and putting them in front, or to chert. And you know what chert is in the Tibetan practice? It's this wonderful woman named Magic Lobdung. Developed this practice, which then was very popular amongst the lay people, eventually was so popular amongst the lay people that all of the schools of Buddhism, of Tibetan Buddhism, now have their own heritage of why it is that Magic Lobdung actually belonged to their school, and that they each have their own little saints about how this teacher was the one who inspired Magic Lobdung to invent chert. It actually wasn't Magic Lobdung at all. It was actually some yogi who died in a cave in south of India and was reborn as Magic Lobdung with full memory that he was actually male. And, you know, all that kind of stuff. Oops, did I say that on tape? Oops. And Magic Lobdung, he's so warden. I'm Magic Lobdung. Om Nachi Lobdung, so beautiful. So these melodies, and you get to play a drum, you know, you ring the bell. You know the demo? And meanwhile, the visualization is that you realize that for the benefit of all beings, you would like to cut through ego clinging, so you give birth to this deity, you shoot out of the top of your head, you image the master, who stuff comes down and whacks the top of your head off. And then your skull turns over and it becomes this cup, and it's just huge. And you cut your body up and you put the pieces in the skull and you boil them in the fires of transcendent wisdom and use that to feed all beings. And this is basically the principle. It's a beautiful, beautiful practice. And basically, the principle is the same as the 32 parts of the body. What you are not. I don't know. There's a book called The Human Anatomy Coloring Book. Do you know that one? Beautiful, beautiful book. I used that when I was doing the parts of the body.
There's probably 100,000 parts.
Yeah, but you could go to the main ones, you know. In the beginning, there's simpler diagrams, yeah. You know. And I, when I first did the practice, I did it according to this, but in Pali. Yeah. And that's how I did it originally. Pesa, Loma, and that. Yeah. And if you want to use, you know, the latest thing, or get one with a proper size clitoris, that's fine. It's all reasonable. Or clitoris, or something like that. Really, it's like breaking down the view. It's like breaking down, like we have a habitual view of who we are. And that stops us from seeing that we're living in a house that's on fire. There is one way out of the house, and we're too busy in the back room pretending there's no fire. And if we see the fire, we'll freak out in the back. So this is like how you make it past the fire through the door. That's the point. That's what we're doing here. We're breaking down the sense that you're safe from the fire because you're in the back room. You know,
don't know, there's no exit there, and you're going to get burned. That's teaching you how to be aware of the fire, walk past, and the best thing you know, like the thing is that you have to become aware. You do not do anything out of joy. I'm sorry, I'm looking around, I see a lot of humans here, you're not going to give up an inch unless you have to. Not really. Not really. I mean, if it sounds good in a crowd, we'll talk a good story. But not until you have no choice. You little knuckles stop being white as do and you kind of peel them off because you got no choice. So like, in a lot of ways it doesn't matter. What matters is that you do something that you're not going to argue with. It will break down your view that you're safe in the bathroom. You don't have to pay attention to this most effective for the time. Go to old age homes, it's very useful. Do you want to say something or can I? I'd like to go on. Is that okay? If you want to add something here?
No, I was just, again, kind of about the guys and that and get to the meeting with them.
Yeah.
How you can add stuff.
So that's the body, basically, because we're not going to talk about the unbeautiful. You don't need to know about, you know, maggots or, you know, bones with some sinew hanging off of them, or bones with no sinew, or bones scattered totally by the birds. You don't even know all that stuff yet, you know. So we're sitting on that part. Second side, or the first step, that's the first step, right? Oh. There. First step. That's the first sign of the first step. That's awareness of body. Five thoughts. Is awareness of feeling. There are five things. Unless you have some experience with jhana, in which case there would be seven. Five feelings are agreeable or pleasurable and painful physical. So what you're doing there, you've got the clear comprehension, and then when you know an agreeable feeling or a disagreeable feeling physically, you put clear comprehension right at that feeling. Because you really would be interested to know what feeling actually is, not what your brain is telling you it is, not your conditioned response to pleasure and pain. But what feeling actually is. And you notice you don't try feeling until you can do body. You have to have broken down a bit of your sense of your identification with the body before you can really perceive feeling. So the first two are agreeable or disagreeable physical feeling. Agreeable, disagreeable mental feeling. I'll give you the seven. Sensual, meaning sensor, sensual feeling. And super sensual feeling. Sensory feeling and super sensory feeling. And the last one of the seven is feeling of indifference, which is basically mental. And that's very useful when you realize that's true, that if you feel one way, you can actually teach yourself how to bring it into more indifference, more like balance feeling off, which is what that first class I gave you, I read that thing about that the Buddha said about the unbeautiful with the beautiful and the beautiful with the unbeautiful. Balancing. That's so gorgeous, isn't it? Over and over again, that's a beautiful feeling. So what you would be doing is you would be when you were going to do the awareness of the breath, you would by practicing just the mindfulness and clear awareness of feeling on the second side of the first step, you would be practicing mindfulness and clarity of comprehension of the breath. I'm sitting and watching mindfulness and clarity of comprehension of the breath with an awareness of the bodily posture. Standing, walking, sitting, and lying are usually the ones that you particularly focus on, but you can also do the in-between. And then any time a feeling comes up of any of those seven things, you turn the focus, you turn the mindfulness and clear comprehension directly on that feeling. And you just observe that feeling. So you switch from the breath to that feeling, and you just observe it. So it's very similar to what happens with the body, with your identity of the body. In other words, you are no longer reacting. You're seeing things as they are. You're not like just quickly reacting, trying to make everything non-feeling, everything womb temperature. Actually explore what is feeling. Super sensory? When you're aware of the angels or elementals or, you know, those phenomena which are not usually perceived in the ordinary sensual range of humans. Some people have more trouble with that than others. Some people like to believe it but can't actually perceive it. If you don't have any experience of that and you don't have any reason to have any understanding of that, it's not important. So usually there's only five thoughts. Usually when you do the practice, the two of sensory and supersensory aren't given as focus. I'm giving them because it is the traditional teaching, although those two do tend to get dropped more and more. I like the traditional stuff. I think it's nice to pass on, you know, how it was and then adapt it. I think it's nice to get instruction according to the time of the Buddha as much as one is able. And then if you want to adapt it, you do that, but you know what you're adapting it from. Is that good? Mm-hmm. It's the same. There's sensory and supersensory. Yeah. That would make nine. There's physical, pleasurable, physical, unpleasurable, mental, pleasurable, mental, unpleasurable, sensory, supersensory, and mental indifference. That makes seven. Yeah. Sensory is basically the sense door being aware of the sense door operating rather than of what you think it is out there. Be aware of the feeling of the sense door energy, the energy of each of the senses. You're sitting there quite aware of when the senses are firing, which way the energy is traveling, in or out, because the senses are called doors. Pali, in the language of the Buddha, because there's two-way traffic. Now, this is not interesting. It actually speaks different. That's what the Karmapa does when he puts his hat on. You've seen those pictures of his on the 16th, 15th, 14th, 13th, etc. Karmapa? And the right eye sending energy out and the left eye is bringing it in. That's what he's doing. Whole different world, huh? Takes a whole different meaning to two-way traffic, doesn't it? Yes, John. They take Valium, yeah. No. Yeah. Like you, for example. And especially in our culture. Yeah, because they don't see any reason to pay attention to a fire, it's not touching their life. Generally speaking, the quickest way, you know, and you know this for many Christians, Judaic or Islamic or any religious training, like, you know, in a time of terror, boy, the population runs a lot faster to their place of worship. True? When there is fear, then you have a reason to reach beyond yourself and you're happy. The Buddha did, you know. He said anybody who isn't fully awakened is totally bonkers, like fanatic. Mad. That's what he said. And my favorite story about my favorite of the Buddha sutras is not even regarded as a sutra. In fact, most people just write it off, but the first teaching he ever gave after he decided that he really could teach, you know that story about, you know, he was up there deciding, well, he just didn't, there was no point in trying because it was too simple, and Brahman needed to, and he realized that, you know, a couple more kalpas and he'd run out of merit and lose his position because even the gods rise and fall, you know. Kind of liked his position as a god there. He realized there was a big chance of getting merit, so he whipped over to where the Buddha was and said, "Hey, yo, teach." And the Buddha said, it's too simple, nobody will understand. Brahma said, "Well, he's got a point there. God, how am I going to counteract this one?" "Oh, yeah, well, there may be a few people, Buddha, with just a little bit of dust in their eyes." The Buddha looks down and, "Oh yeah, there are. Yeah, one or two people who have just a little dust in their eyes. Okay. And who don't mind. Who are totally blinded." By stardust, can actually maybe see what he had to do. And it was just a place. Okay, for those who have little dust, I'll be. So he hangs around for another 6 weeks there and, you know, does some further meditation on cause and effect and develops the 12 links of interdependence, and you know, he goes and meditates there and plays around with the, you know, visiting this realm and that realm, visits his mother, and so she died when he was a week old, you know, perfect childhood, perfect mother, she just wasn't there. And that's how to be a perfect mother. And then, okay, it's time to teach, so he says, where am I going to go? So he does this sort of overview thing, that's what this, I suppose, can do. And he sees the five guys that he spent so much time with, fasting and purging and eating a grain of rice each every day, and so he decided that actually the only thing that really seemed to accomplish was to make him faint from hunger, and it wasn't exactly clear mind, and maybe he could do something else. And he sees these five, and he thinks, well, yeah, they actually could hear me. So he starts walking toward them, and on the way he meets this Brahmin. This is a fully awakened, newly fully awakened Buddha, right? He's just walking along the road, headed for these five guys. And this Brahmin is coming along, and he's got, you know, the groceries, he's taking them home. And the Brahmin looks and says, "Oh, you got a real light shining. I see you've got some kind of, I see you have some kind of attainment." That's what basically he said. And the Buddha says, "Yes, I have awakened." And the Brahmin says, "Well, that's nice. Excuse me, the wife's waiting for the groceries." Isn't that wonderful? I find that absolutely wonderful. And that was his first discourse, and it's hard to say who learned the most. But I think he learned a lot about teaching, isn't it? There. Me, huh? Because that guy was happy. And especially in a culture where Buddhism is not, you know, the normal way, the formula for if you're unhappy, you should just have go pray or have better, you know. We are basically a Judeo-Christian society, isn't it? Yeah. unless you're Maori, but then if you're a Maori, you wouldn't be in Tasmania anyway, you just kind of wipe out all the Maori people. Yeah. Is that right? Or Aboriginals? Yeah. Yeah. Wrong island. I think we did cover that in Alberta too. That's European. So you know, and Buddhism is perfect for people who are really, really don't fit in, can't get gold cards, because it's even more remote than Christianity. Can't fit into Christianity, but you can actually. So very often Buddhism will attract people who are really curious, but sort of like in a shopping kind of mood, or people who are desperate. So therefore, you get some really good practitioners in Buddhism. Really good practitioners. Most of the people who turn up really are very sincere about wanting to do something in their life. And it's very rewarding. Because it works. It works because it's common sense. The Buddha was not a slouch. He knew something. He knew common sense, he knew how to live. And desire to alleviate suffering for the benefit of all beings, and he had a plan. It's called the 37 exercises. He hit with his design.
Along the line, to follow on from John, I believe I've heard the Buddha say to someone, "Are they asleep and they don't know it?" Most of the people sleep and they don't know it. And then in my life as a Buddhist and a practitioner, most of my friends are completely happy with this and that and everything else. And I think, sometimes I think they're very enlightened people, even though they've never, in my knowing, practiced, or I'll tell me they've never practiced. And then you read things like, in Buddhist, there's that conscious suffering and unconscious suffering. And then, I think that's what makes the difference. Whether you're suffering or not, somehow you wake up and then you can really get, if you wake up and have it, if you see the real situation, like you're saying, when you realise that the house is on fire, I guess you have to do something.
Either go back to sleep or look for the way out.
Well, you could, but
I'll get some marshmallows.
Could you say something else?
Hello, is this a marshmallow scent takeout? You spend over 20 pounds of marshmallows?
Yeah, to the point that I think you have to be awake, to wake up a little bit, to realise how asleep you are and how much you are suffering,
mm-hmm.
or how much you will suffer for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you have anything to say about conscious, so-called conscious suffering,
yeah.
and unconscious suffering?
Yeah, and that's called two meditations that you do if you're having trouble focusing on practice. One is called presence even birth, and the other is called meditation on impermanence. And if you're having any trouble at all focusing on your practice, it doesn't matter what that trouble is. If you do those two meditations, even for a week, you will not have the trouble you have before. They are the antidote for that difficulty in being motivated to do practice. And we all have 1,001 excuses for not doing a daily practice, and they're all quite reasonable, but they don't help us do a daily practice. So if you want to do a daily practice, work with precious members and impermanence. And you're good. Precious human birth. I gave out that write-up of it. First, was that last weekend? If anybody wants a copy, you can just talk to Mr. Dick. And it's 8 points, so you can just read. You can put it in the bathroom, is my suggestion. Or the toilet there. Just there for 5 minutes, read the first one, then focus on that all day. And then the next day, read the next one, focus on that. You don't even have to sit, just start sitting. You guys can just take one when you're not going to go anywhere else. You just, like, you don't have to go and meditate to do it or anything, you know. Just read it and then start thinking about it during the day, and the next day take the next point, read it, and start. Yeah. And pretty soon you'll find your mind starts changing. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I don't care how. Do you know somebody who's happy all the time? John? Or a lot of the time? Basically a happy person? Pardon?
It's not specific,
right? Yeah, so you do know somebody like that? Do you, yes or no? Yes? Is that a yes? Okay. And do they ever feel anger? Ever feel any slight irritation or anger? Is that a yes? Is that a yes? Do they ever feel, ever in their whole life, ever feel any slight irritation? Are they able to acknowledge that irritation? Any level, conscious level. And not just the imagination. So when there is an acknowledgement of that irritation, does that do anything to change their sense of happiness? What does it do? I know, I'm not going to tell you the answer. I am. I'm asking you whether, if a happy person is aware of irritation occasionally, does that awareness of the irritation that occasionally arises in change the state of happiness? Does it? So they're not actually happy all the time. But they prefer to only be aware of the happy times and ignore the non-happy times. Would that be accurate? Then I would think that they're not aware of the fire that's in the house. Does that help? Okay. I'd like to just plunge ahead here. Do you have more questions? Is that reasonable? It can seem like happiness if you want to ignore the unhappiness. And we all want to ignore the unhappiness. But if you do ignore the unhappiness, it gets bigger, the fire keeps growing, and then one time the unhappiness is right there, and you haven't, through the little moment, learned how to work with it. So it's like refusing to be inoculated against something that is going to attack you, fight you, big sometimes, and you're not going to know how to handle it at all. Every one of us, at some point or other, are going to be faced with absolute despair. Every one of us has to lose everything. Not one of us gets out of that. One way or the other, sometime in our lives, whether it's through a child, right? Whether it's through someone else, whether it's through our own sense of inadequacy, whatever it may be, every one of us has to have the bottom drop out. Because what we think of as safety is never safety, whether it's personal pain physically or anything else. Anything that comes and does that message, you know, to Caesar by your ear, remember that you are mortal, that is to say you too are conditioned. Dependent on conditions, they are not always satisfactory, but it's not going on. Don't ignore this. Don't just believe what you like. It does not seem things as they are, and you're going to get a big shock. And that's worse than not knowing. I guess that's it. So whenever you feel, when you're watching the breath and you have mindfulness and clarity of comprehension, then whenever you get any one of the seven feelings, or at least the five, immediately turn your attention to that, clearly perceive it, and hold your focus on that, and just examine that feeling. And it will arise, and it will dissolve, and it will arise, and it will dissolve. And when it is absolutely dissolved, then you go back to the breath. Until you actually understand what feelings are. When you're doing mindfulness and clarity of comprehension of feelings, you start by just sitting and watching the breath with an overall awareness of the body, right? Watching the breath. And then whenever any feeling arises while you're watching with mindfulness and clearly comprehending the breath, you immediately turn the focus to whatever that feeling is, right? Whether it's one of the five feelings or one of the seven feelings, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. You don't have to do the same. Time is just time. And as soon as you do that, you turn your attention and you just pay direct attention to that, not your idea about what that is, but the actual experience of that feeling. And you focus on that. And when the feeling, it will go through various changes, at some point it will dissolve, then you go back to mindfulness and clarity of comprehension with breath. Basically you do that, then third time, the first step is involved with contemplation of mental state. The point of this exercise is to develop clear perception and understanding. That, for example, a greedy mind is greedy. It is greedy mind. A hateful mind.